Hello film fans, welcome to a brand new episode of Soundtracking with me, Edith Bowman. Now this week, we are coming to you from a slightly more glamorous location than usual, as I am currently slowly crawling my way along the Croisette to the red carpet of the Palais Theatre for the 77th edition of the Cannes Film Festival. This episode, I'm so thrilled to say, is brought to you by our very dear friends at BMW, who have been partners of the festival for the past 3 years and have given us the opportunity to be here at the festival and share this experience with you. Now, there are so many great films in and out of competition at the festival, and we really hope that over the next year or so, we get the chance to bring you as many of those storytellers as possible to the podcast. And we're really lucky to start that journey this week. Now, Furiosa had its European premiere at Cannes just a few days ago, and I was there to savour up the atmosphere and witness the incredible reaction the film received. I was also lucky enough to catch up with composer Tom Holkenborg just the morning after the premiere. Sorry about that, Tom. And director George Miller just a few days later in London. That's coming up shortly, but first let's hear from Tom, who returns to the Fury Road to tell this origin story. And we'll begin with one of his cues, The Stowaway. Tom, it's so great to see you. I was just saying we've been talking about you for the past couple of weeks because we had Zach on the podcast a couple of weeks ago. But listen, it's the morning after the Cannes screening of Furiosa. How was it for you? I've seen it. Congratulations. But what was that reaction like?
It's fantastic. It's not my first time in Cannes, but it's my first time as a composer in Cannes. I used to have an artist career for 25 years, and I actually came to the festival before to play on the after parties. So I've done some wild parties here, like in the 90s and such. Yeah, I couldn't make it 10 years ago with Fury Road came out here. I couldn't make it 2 years ago when 3,000 Years of Longing came out here. And so three times is a time, you know, I have to be here. And, you know, it's such an old festival. So many incredible filmmakers have stood on those stairs and just like waving at the cameras, and to be there with that cast and with George, he has become actually one of my best friends. Besides working, and last night I gave him a hug, and it was almost like I got a little emotional when I walked home, because you know, just like I said to him, I'm not sure when I'm going to see you again, you know, and you get so used to see each other every day for so like intense. 4 or 5 months, you know, in Sydney, and then poof, you know, that person is gone again for a little bit until you see each other again.
Yeah. But, till the next film.
Sorry?
Till the next one.
Exactly. Exactly. But it was fantastic all in all. And to see the final results, of the film, it was extra special for me because on one hand, I'm the composer on this film, but on the other hand, I also mixed the film together with somebody else. Wow. So I was really involved with the film really until 3 weeks ago. And so I came back home. I crashed for a week. I made 2 weeks, I have to say. I made sure I had enough microwave food in the fridge and everything else. And after 10 days or so, it's like, maybe I should go outside and see what the world looks like.
When did the conversation start with George after Fury Road about Furiosa and about it being...
During Fury Road, always. I knew so much about this film already. It was really interesting because I worked with George on three different films. Our working method has been completely different on the three films, whereas Fury Road, 60% of the movie was there, but the beginning and the ending was not there. And it was more of a third-party perspective. You know, you see everything unfold on the screen. You get to know the wasteland and its new form. You follow so many different characters and situations. Mm-hmm. And so the music was really adapting that. So if you saw something big on screen, the music was huge and with choir and a rock opera. Thousand Years of Longing, a drama, or a modern fairy tale, if you will. Completely different way of working, completely different film. I wrote all the music based on the script and conversations with George, and he actually played the music on the set when the actors were acting out. And completely different way of working. Furiosa, we had only conversations about the film, but only 10% of our time was devoted to the film. The rest of all our conversations, you should ask him that. All our conversations, they go on about so many different things in life that we have an interest in. And only 10% we talk about the film. And we strongly believe, the both of us, that by not talking about the film and about other subjects that are meaningful to us, we understand each other better and we understand then why certain things are the way that they are in a film or in the music. And it's an interesting process, but you should ask him that too, what he has to say about that. And so for this movie, he said, I'm going to give you the movie when I feel it's ready. And okay. So normally I would see a film way earlier, but I saw it relatively late in the process. But based on all the conversations that I had with him, I knew what I needed to prepare on forehand. It's almost like you ask a contractor to remodel your kitchen. The contractor is going to arrive with tools and gear and whatever that person needs that are focused on remodeling a kitchen. He's not going to arrive with the bathtub, if that makes any sense. Yeah. So by all the conversations I had with George, I knew what I needed to prepare. I knew what needed to be in my box of tools before I saw the film. And from that point forward, like, it was rather relatively quickly, because I had so much, I was able to paint a canvas and then showed it to George pretty quickly on. And from that point forward, we just like started finessing. And the final finessing was like the last 4.5 months in Sydney.
It's really interesting because for this character, you know, there are different emotional states that we find her in this film, and that's really reflected in the music, I think, as well. Was that the kind of almost the key and the heartbeat for you in terms of finding the
absolutely elements? And it's funny you say heartbeat, because the three major elements in this film that define the score. Well, first off, it's a first person perspective film. We see everything through the eyes of Furiosa. It's her interpretation of the wasteland as she sees it. And that's what the music also needed to do. So when there's an action sequence of 40 minutes and people are wondering, why is there no music the first 5-6 minutes of the action sequence? It's because we don't even know that Furiosa is there. We see her at a certain point under the truck, and that's where the music starts coming in. If this were a scene in Fury Road, it would have been a massive bombastic score, but not for this movie, because the approach is different. Now, the three elements that are key to this film, one is what we call the moan, and it's a very aggressive, gnarly beast of a sound, and we call it the darkest of gods, or the fifth rider of the apocalypse, and it's darker than dark. When she first meets Dementus and she sees all the cruelties of the wastelands, lessons of the wastelands, and how her mother is being killed, we hear that sound because that's how she views Dementus. Mm. Eventually, when she loses her arm, and eventually where the map is drawn on how to get back to the green place, I'll talk about that in a second, which she promised her mom, she now loses all hope of ever going back to the green place. The map is gone. She will not be able to find it. So that's the moment where there's only one thing left in her, and that is the ultimate form of hate. And that wonderful conversation between Dementus and Furiosa at the end, when he says, "You are like me. We are the same." That beautiful line: "Nothing will equal the suffering of your loved ones. You will never, you can never balance the scale of their suffering," is what he says. And so she has become him. And so that gnarly moan type sound is how she views Dementus, but that's what she becomes at the end of the movie. That's one. Second is, you mentioned the heartbeat. There are pulses in this film that constantly follow her heartbeat, like what she's feeling. Sometimes it's slow and steady. Sometimes it's on the go. Like she becomes this, she gets this crash course during that action sequence, how to become a road warrior. And eventually she becomes that road warrior. Mm-hmm. And so the pulse is always there to emphasize her heartbeat and what she's feeling. The third thing is the combination of the duduk played by Pedro Ustash and the didgeridoo played by William Barton. Those two instruments signify the harmonious connection of the green place, the people that live there, in harmony with each other, in harmony with nature, with the animals. And it had to be such a pure sound. And the didgeridoo, clearly now, we see this is not anywhere. No, this is smack right in the middle of Australia. And so it made total sense to work with two incredible musicians that really give you that earthy nature harmony type of sounds. It starts where we see the green place and it comes back every now and then. And she's reminded of her mom or when she's reminded of the green place. And that signifies on screen with the pit of a peach. So the peach is a very important symbol through that. And the duduk and the didgeridoo follow that every time when we see it, but we don't hear it. When she loses the arm, it's over. Now it's the darkest of gods.
Wow. It's amazing. That is just such a great way of highlighting to people how important the music is in the storytelling, and none more so in this film. And you know, the duduk you talk about, just the kind of the deep emotion that that instrument kind of evokes is just extraordinary. Literally gets to your soul, doesn't it? It's incredible. It's just
we used a little bit of the duduk in Fury Road when Furiosa, Charlize Theron in that movie, is basically discovering that the green place no longer exists. It's gone. And so we hear a little bit of that over there. So because this is not only a prequel, but part of the prequel building of the movie is how do we tell a first-person perspective story, George as a filmmaker, the actors, me as a composer, and how do we bring it to the start of Fury Road? It's 100% connected right there. At the very end of the movie, it's like, poof, now we're at the start of Fury Road, where it started.
It's almost like Rogue One going into a new
exactly.
Movie. Exactly. Yeah. Totally.
And so actually, it's like if you would see the movies in succession, like this movie is basically an incredible build-up to then the 2 hour of an action sequence, you know, to get out of the citadel with these wives.
Yeah.
And so that was the whole point. How do we set that up? What musical themes do we introduce in this film so they get the payoff in Fury Road? And George did that with storytelling and directing and editing and all that.
The other thing that I think is really, what I really wanted to talk to you about was the Chris Hemsworth character, because the way that Chris plays that, and I'm sure that that was part of the way it was written in the script, is like the tone is kind of really mixed up in terms of he's darker than dark, but then he's hilarious as well. You know, it's kind of, it's a really interesting tonal character.
Yeah.
To reflect that in the music that you kind of have around that character, yeah, or themes for that character. Do you mind talking a little bit about that? Because that's quite a unique thing, I think.
Yeah, well, I mean, as I just mentioned earlier, is that the Darkest of Gods sound that is used for Dementus through the eyes of Furiosa, and she becomes that at the very end. Dementus himself has his own storyline throughout the movie. At the end of the movie, we figure out, it's like, okay, he had a family once,
yeah,
a partner and kids taken, exactly, taken from him unjustly and probably murdered or tortured, whatever. But actually, when we see Dementus for the first time, he kind of looks like a reasonable guy, you know, and you see him getting unhinged through the movie, and everything gets weirder and weirder and weirder for him, and eventually he's only left with five or six of his bikers, and the rest is all gone in the 40 days wasteland war with Immortan. And that's it. And he now becomes the hunted. So she becomes the hunter. He becomes the hunted. What's very interesting underlying detail in the film, and George will I'm sure talk about that, is the vehicles in the movie reflect where that person is at that specific point in state of mind or in. So Furiosa is brought in on a bike. And then we see Dementus and the History Man is talking about like a shiny bike. Then later, when things get more grandeur, like for him, and more grandiose and more over the top, he now has like a chariot with three bikes in front of him. And then later, he's got the 6 foot where he becomes really, really powerful. And Furiosa is right at the top of her game when she drives into this in the second war rig, now together with Praetorian Jack. A little detail, the first time when we see the war rig, it's only one tanker. But the second time we see it, it's two tankers. And so it's more powerful, it has more storage. And then later when they flee from the site, they're back into like an old repurposed 50s Valiant car. And they're way weaker than Dementus. And they're going to be the prey of Dementus, which is playing out. And from that moment forward, like, things start to change. So when she is chasing Dementus, it's the most powerful car that there is at that point in the wasteland. And he is on a really shitty bike. And so he's no match for her.
Oh, that's so interesting. There's so many elements that are telling you the story. Before we run out of time, there's another brilliant image that obviously is across the two films, which is the guitar-wielding gentleman on the back of, you know,
the Doof Warrior.
Yeah. What's his name?
Doof Warrior.
Doof Warrior. Doof Warrior. What can you tell me about the Doof Warrior?
The Doof Warrior is an incredible character, and he's like, you've seen it in the past, you know, when the Romans would march on, you know, to take like another country or another, there would always be like a guy that would blow on a horn.
Scotland with bagpipes.
Exactly. The Vikings had like, you know, just like, here we come, you know, the war is going to start. So in the wastelands, that is the Doof Warrior, who is in front of a truck with all kinds of old guitar speakers and megaphones just like connected together to make as gnarly of a sound as possible, with six drummers on the back that are really like playing the drums of war, like you had like also on these Roman ships when these people, the slaves, were rowing, and you had like a drum beat, you know, just like how fast I needed to row. And so that's the whole purpose of the Doof Warrior, with the drums, the drummers behind. Dufour had a very important part to play in the first movie. And here we see him because he clearly was being used in the 40 days wasteland war. But it's more or less clear there's no winners and there's no losers. I would say Dementis is more diminished. He only has 5-6 bike riders left. Mm. And Immortan has such an incredible army, 972 to be exact, which is being mentioned at the beginning of the meeting between them. And I'm sure he lost a good amount in that war, but he's still very strong to hold on to that citadel. But that's the function of the Doof Warrior.
See, in my head, I had, it's like, you're actually the Doof Warrior.
I was like, yeah,
you can't see his face. I think it's Tom behind there. He's the one wielding the guitar.
No,
Tom,
I mean, like, if George would have called me and he would have said, Tom, I've got this great idea. I want you to sit in front of a truck in Africa for 9 months in the blaring sun playing guitar. Oh, by the way, your face is completely unrecognizable and you're going to wear this hideous red outfit. I might say, George, I think I can use that time better for maybe working on the score. And so what I remember of it, it's a very talented guitar player from Australia that actually played that role.
You can tell
role.
From his movements. You can tell that he's a musician.
Yeah. No,
he reminds me of Flea from the Red Hot Chili Peppers. Kind of like gets really down there with that guitar, the straps really long.
And then when we started working on the score, he didn't want to use the original guitar sounds. And he said to me, well, why don't you do it? And I play guitar. But he said, it needs to match exactly what his fingers are doing. And I was like, what? And so I had to analyze what he did. And I was able to come up with the riff as if he actually played it. So
that's amazing.
That was funny, yeah.
Oh, Tom, I could chat to you for hours about this. And I hope we get the chance to do it again. But congratulations on another extraordinary
job. Thank you so
much. And it's lovely to celebrate with you here in Cannes. So thank you so much.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me.
From the score to Furiosa, a Mad Max saga, that was The Promise from Tom Holkenborg. And now to director George Miller, who I was very excited to catch up with back in London just days after his film premiered at the Cannes Film Festival. George, I'm so thrilled that I'm getting the chance to talk to you about this world and these characters that have been part of our cinema watching world for quite a few years now. But congratulations on Furiosa. You must be thrilled with the response.
You know, it's one of the things that happens. You work hard on a film, suddenly it's finished, and then you offer it up into the world. And it's really, really interesting part of the process because, in a sense, the audiences tell you what you've made, what it somehow means to them. It's in the eyes of the beholder. It varies, and at some point a kind of consensus settles on the film, good or bad. And that's a really exciting part. It's a dynamic part of the process, and I've always learned something from that.
That's really nice that you take something back from that experience with the audience.
Big time. Yeah, I find myself, what keeps me going, I'm not only interested about how to tell stories, but why we tell stories and what stories mean. Stories is an interaction with an audience. There's no story without an audience. Yeah. And so that's interesting to me.
Why did you want to tell Furiosa's story then? Because it's such a beautiful journey in the fact that, you know, a lot of the story in this script was written before Fury Road because you needed that essence.
Yes, definitely needed it.
To be able to tell that story.
Yeah.
So that's quite a unique thing in terms of it's been there in some way, shape or form for quite some time.
Yes, it's in fact, I can't think, because we had to write that story out of necessity, I don't think there could have been a coherent Fury Road where the internal logic works unless we did it.
Yeah.
And having that story and then having the opportunity to tell it, it's a story that runs directly into Fury Road. I can't think of other circumstances except someone pointed out the other day that Godfather 2, which followed Godfather 1, was the kind of origin story of a lot of those characters, even though it was a bit more complex than that. But I can't think of too many others like that.
When you were thinking about the sound of this film in comparison to Fury Road, both with music, because I know that Tom worked really, really, really closely with Rob McKenzie on this, you know, in terms of, but it's a very different musically sounding film.
Yeah.
Is that mainly because of the perspective of how we're seeing the story told? It's through Furiosa's eyes.
Exactly. I think Fury Road is essentially, happens over 3 days and three nights, and was essentially a story of a chase where Max and Furiosa get caught up being chased by the Praetorian, by Mort and Joe, because the five wives are being taken, and then at a certain point it becomes a race back to the Citadel. So it's got that sort of propulsion to it. Mm-hmm. This story happens over 18 years, and its rhythms are different. I guess its tones are different.
Yeah.
It's a saga in which we see somebody go from childhood and somehow becomes forged somehow in the chaos of this world and the brutality of this world into kind of a warrior, but almost a quasi-mythical figure.
Mm-hmm.
And all of that has to be expressed, is best expressed through the music, I think.
And much more kind of emotional depth to it as well. And that's kind of told so brilliantly through, you know, what Tom's written, but also the choice of instrumentation as well, with the Duduk and things like that, in terms of it's got such beauty to it when we have certain moments where it appears in the film.
Two things that were interesting about this. Tom used the Duduk in the first movie. In this movie, which is very clearly set in Australia, the centre of a vast continent like Australia, 45 years after the fall of man, whatever caused that, and right in the centre, in the isolation of the centre of Australia, this story plays out in the wasteland. And it was very interesting to me to use the didgeridoo.
Yeah.
William Barton, who's an extraordinary musician, he kind of plays the didgeridoo, which is incredible. That's such an ancient instrument.
Yeah.
One could argue older than any other that exists on this planet. That culture is at least 65,000 years old. Who knows when the didgeridoo came along, but it's certainly very old. And to hear that played by someone with such skill and virtuosity, in the same time that he can almost sing and do it. He's a wonderful composer in his own right and has done many performances around the world of his pieces, including this. And to bring those two together which Tom kind of was very excited about and fused them together, somehow even made it, the music somehow bedded the movie down into a timeless place.
Yeah. Interesting, because he said that when you were having conversations, you know, around, you know, what your asks were, what you were looking for and things, it wasn't really about the film, it wasn't really about the story or the narrative, you were just talking about life, you were talking about, you know, the world and what's going on. And so it's amazing that just that natural conversation has inspired such brilliant connective, you know, creativity within the film.
Look, one of the things that really always excited me about working with composers is that you get down deep into the subtext of a story. You have these conversations when you're writing, usually writing with somebody. You're talking about the characters, you're talking about the world, and as they come together and out of the interaction of the characters, out of the conflict between characters or the world, some essence is basically revealed. Mm. And we talk a lot about this, the deep subtext of the story and the characters. That's in the writing. Then you go through the shooting, you have some of those conversations with the actors and the designers and the cast and crew and so on. But then when you come back at the very end, having cut the film, and then you're now talking to the composer, echoes of those conversations happen again with the composer. Mm. And when you work with someone who's a kind of, like Tom is quite the polymath. He you know, he studied law, he's done all kinds of music, from pop to orchestral and everything else, sound design, all there. And he's somebody who's able to articulate things that I never understood about music before. And that's always a really exciting conversation. Yeah. So, yes, you have to start very broadly before you get down into the more granular details of the story.
And also those moments where you don't use music, because that makes it even more powerful in a way, you know, in terms of the expectation of there to be kind of score plastered across those big, huge set pieces.
Yeah.
And you've done this fantastic thing where there are moments where you really hold back.
Yes.
We don't hear music, and it almost makes you hold your breath in a way. It's so powerful.
Yeah.
And again, does that go back to, because it's her point of view. It's, you know, in terms.
Yes, and in a way, inviting at various moments, you're inviting the audience to reflect on what's happening or experience something that's happening. Most of the music in this is her point of view.
Yeah.
Because it's a sprawling story, and you always want to make sure that it relates to her basic thread of the narrative.
Yeah.
And silence can be, in the right circumstances, just as powerful as the loudest sound. I mean, it's the balance between the two, the contrast between the two, the almost the contradiction of it that yeah. makes it so powerful.
The other person, though, that we definitely hear has, you know, has their own themes and stuff is Chris Hemsworth's character.
Yeah.
And Anya's phenomenal, and yeah. but Chris, in terms of the tone that he brings, you yeah. know, in the script, but also in the performance, this kind of almost quite sort of Shakespearean in yeah. times, you know, and really interesting when you think about his origin story. Yeah. To how he got to where he is now,
yeah.
and how the music as well kind of takes you at times through that story in a way.
Dementis is an interesting character because he's kind of a variation of the theme that we've seen all through history.
Yeah.
A kind of marauding, charismatic, showman-type leader. We still see those in the world today
yeah.
in various parts. And he uses a kind of that, and in a sense, humour, almost a trickster quality that he kind of uses to bring people around him. And Chris got onto that pretty quickly. And he understood the character, understood that he wasn't just one-dimensional, sort of malevolent. He understood why he was like that
yeah.
to some degree. I remember Chris, when he read the screenplay, he picked up on it. And at a certain point, not long before the shoot, he wrote a journal. He woke up in the middle of the night and he started writing about 5 pages from Dementis' point of view, how he was in the world and why he was like that. And I can tell from the way he wrote it, he never lifted the pen off the page. There were 3 words crossed out and he started again in one particular spot. And it was a kind of a stream of consciousness about who he was and how he came to be and feel the way he does and what he came to believe in yeah. all of these. And it was so insightful and deeply felt. I thought, God, if this informs the character on the screen, that's going to be really interesting to see. And as we were shooting the scenes, I was just taken aback by what he ended up doing.
Yeah.
It really was.
It's so true what you say about it kind of lulls you into a false sense of security where
yeah.
you're laughing with him
yeah.
and then he just flips yeah. into yeah. this kind yeah. of demonic kind of, yeah, it's such a great performance.
Yeah.
In terms of as well, I did sort of scream out loud, not scream out loud, but I was like, yes, when Doof Warrior appeared in this one as well,
yeah.
I like that we get Doof Warrior
yeah,
in this.
Yeah, yeah.
What was the, do you mind talking a little bit about the kind of origins of that character for you in terms of what it kind of symbolises, why it was, you know, it's in Fury Road and in here and yeah, because yeah, it's...
Well, it's interesting to me that we know, we had to, in order for Iota, who plays him, who's a musician himself and a wonderful performer, we had to know how he came to survive in the wasteland. How does a man who's essentially, well, completely blind, and all he can do is play a guitar,
yeah.
that's the way he expresses himself in the world, how does he survive in the wasteland? What's his backstory? That was a really interesting thing. We know he came into the world of the Immortan Joe, and Immortan Joe had this wonderful use for him, which is to make him the bugler, the drummer, the person who calls people into war. That's how people, you know, in pre-20th
yeah.
century radio technology and all the rest of it, were basically, that was a constant in wars. But this is a world, and even though it goes back to those, the behaviour
yeah.
is back in those times. It still has some of the technology of the 20th century, which is the vehicles. So you can't have bugling when all these roaring engines are going on, or drumming, or fifes, or bagpipes, or anything
yeah.
else. You had to have something really loud, which is the Doof Wagon with lots of speakers and a really wild guitar. Even though it's on the surface of it, it's hyperbolic, but it had to have its own internal logic.
Mm.
That's how he came about. And he appears again, particularly when there's war
yeah.
in this story briefly.
I was glad to see him again.
Yeah, yeah.
yeah. I wanted just to talk a little bit about the different stages as a director that you kind of have to go through with creating something like this. And, you know, these big set pieces that we see in Furiosa, you know, once again, they take your breath away. They're exciting, they're exhilarating. You hold your breath with excitement and they go on and they're almost kind of short films in themselves. In terms of the
preparation for that and the choreography in your head, you know, of what's in here that's going down there to then go on the page?
Well, it's each sequence has different requirements, of course, but if you take like a big action sequence, the first and most important thing, they're basically character driven, and they serve the progression of the characters. They serve the story of the characters. Otherwise, if it's just a lot of noise and action, it's just empty calorie action, I call it. So that's the first thing. So you write it in terms of the character. It might be in words, it might be spoken, it might be sketched out in some way. You might do some, you know, some early concept art, and they become storyboards. And then in this case, we used a system devised by Guy Norris, with whom I've been working with for 41 years, who was a young stuntman on the second Mad Max. And Guy and his sons developed the system called Proxy, which is a very efficient way to previs. Previs can be painstaking. That's how most animations are done, like a Happy Feet or whatever. Yeah. But now the technology is much, much faster. So they devised a system where we could actually take, for instance, a vehicle like that big chrome war rig. We could shoot underneath it, on top, in front, at the back, mm-hmm. and in the airspace around it. And not only that, put our cameras in and move our cameras, whether they were locked off cameras or they were part of the edge arm, which is the crane car that can go anywhere around it. The cameras are so much more agile now. And even if we had drones, that all of that could be done virtually. And we could see the connection between one shot to the next. If movies are visual music, and just as there's a connection between one note or one chord and the next, so it is with the syntax of cinema.
Yeah.
And there's a lot in common with that. So we put all those together. We'd see how it flowed. It didn't lock us in, but it gave everyone an idea of what we needed to do. So that had to be rehearsed with various cranes and people harnessed and all those people, you know, in the shot, all the action. And then you shoot it. That sequence took 78 days to shoot, which is a ridiculously long time, out in the centre of Australia. Guy and his unit were working. I was back in Sydney on another unit. We were, you know, going back and forward, and gradually we built the sequence. So it's using the tools as they become available to sort of enhance the sequences. So it starts off in the imagination and grows through all those iterations until it becomes real. Yeah.
I love the commitment you have, though, to as much of it as possible, you know, being real, being physical, being there, being, you know, being able to, that it's the real thing. So you really feel that. You feel that kind of, that they're driving, you know, they're driving around and along this kind of, this road. You kind of feel like you're on it in a way with them.
Oh, good. Yeah. Look, this is a film, as I say, in this world, nothing defies the laws of physics. There are no flying men or spacecraft or anything like that. It's all rooted in the physical world. So if you're watching anything, you've got to make sure that where the eye scan goes, the primary thing, the primary action, whether it's a human body, an object, a vehicle, it has to be real. Then you can use CG to do a lot of things. First of all, you can take all the wires and harnesses and rigging that helps the stuntman or the vehicle do whatever they need to do. You can erase, if you're working in the desert, you can erase the tracks of previous takes, which you couldn't in the past. You know, if something doesn't quite go right or the camera misses it a little bit and you've still got the space, you can adjust the camera in post a little bit.
Yeah,
that doesn't happen very often because we the cameras are already carefully rehearsed along with the stunts. You know, I've been lucky enough to work with really great camera operators. So, yeah.
Amazing collaboration with so many of your team on this one.
Yeah, very happy about that. You know, on the shooting crew, there were 1,200 people on the crew out there. And on the first Mad Max made 40 years ago, there were 30 people on the crew.
No!
It's different now, particularly with something, you know, like this.
Wow. Speaking of the old films, I've been singing We Don't Need Another Hero for days my head. So it's been lovely to kind of reacquaint yourself with that, but also, like you say, these characters in the story that's been with us for nearly 40 years. It's brilliant that there's still more to tell. And is there more to tell?
In the same way we wrote the story of Furiosa in order to help, as a tool to help us make Fury Road, we wrote something called The Wasteland, which tells of the year, what Max was doing in the year before we meet up with him in Fury Road. So that's there, and depending on how Furiosa goes, and if everything, all the planets align, as I say, we'll shoot. I hope to see that made sometime, some way.
Yes. George, but it's a brilliant gift. Yeah. I think, considering the response the film has had, even before it's released to the general public, I would get that shooting schedule in place now, because I think that it's definitely needs to be up.
Well, they take a lot of planning, but that's there waiting in the wings, as it were, along with a couple of other stories, nothing to do with Mad Max. So. Yeah. That's what you have to do in this world. You can't help it. I find myself preparing a lot of things, some which will never be made, and others, it's a lifelong habit now.
When do you know when it's done? In terms of you're in the edit and you're doing all post on the film. There's a journey on the film from what's written, what you film, then when you go into the edit and stuff. How do you know when it's done? How do you know when it's the film that you kind of want to lock?
Well, that's really interesting. Look, I often say, this is assuming you've written the screenplay as tightly as you can. Mm. It's assuming that you've prepared as rigorously you can, and it's assuming that you've got most of what you wanted on the production.
Yeah.
When you get into the cutting room, let's say it takes 100% of effort and time to get to about 80% of the potential of the story. You've got to double that effort to get the next, say, 15%, let's say to 95%. Then you've got to double that effort again to get that next 5%, and so on and so on, until you get to where you think, and you sense you've kind of mined or milked all the potential that you have there, but using all the techniques and tools and adjustments that you might make in the story, and you get to that sort of last 1%, and it where you think there's nothing much else we can do. That depends on working with really good people, and you have to be really honest with yourself. You can't fool yourself into thinking that you've got something and that's working. And that last sort of 1.5% where you think if you double that effort again, you'd only improve it that little bit. Around about that time, you say, well, it won't make any difference to the overall. But I've seen over and over again that when the first cut of your movie or the early cuts of the movie, some people attempted to say, oh, well, it's pretty done. I know that you can get a lot more out of it. My partner, Margaret Siegel, who cut Fury Road, she's got a particular skill out of seeing, when I think it's almost complete, she sees a lot more that can be done with it that really hones the story. And that's a really interesting thing to go through. So that's when I know it's done. and we were lucky enough on this one not to run out of time. I mean, we only finished 3 weeks ago, but I know in that 3 weeks, in that time, everything was done to that, as far as I was concerned, to that level where I don't think we could have gotten any more out of the film.
Wow, I feel so lucky, because it feels like it's still hot off the press, and the fact that they only finished it 3 weeks ago. That's crazy.
We had that deadline. and very much that applied to the sound and music as well.
Yeah.
The great thing about this mix is that Tom and Rob McKenzie were the only two mixers. Tom being the composer in the United States and England and other places, they can't mix it. It's something, I don't know what the protocol is. They can't mix the music. But in this case, because he's so skilled, he's been doing it for so long, he's the logical person to not only compose, but actually mix it. Rob is a musician himself, but he's an incredibly fine sound mixer. He won an Academy Award for Hacksaw Ridge, for sound. And the two got together really early. Instead of effects and music fighting for their status in the movie, it was in concert. And it worked really, really well. I'm very pleased with what happened.
Do you ever have music around on set? Do you ever play, have music, you know?
We don't, except actors often do it to get into the mood of the scene. I often see them. And I think people working on the set, I think they're allowed to have music, you know, people working on vehicles. And the safety protocols, you need to be, you know, if you need your ears, you've got to be very, very careful. But I have done in the past, but it didn't seem to be as important in this, in most of the scenes here.
Yeah. I'm interested to know what's on Chris and Anya's playlist for their characters. I wonder what music they chose to have in their ears to get them in the mood and to psych them up for those characters.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I'll try and ask them.
All right.
It's so great to chat to you. Genuinely, real pleasure. And congratulations on the film. And I really look forward to Wasteland as well.
Oh, that's thanks, fantastic.
Rod. Yeah, thank
so
you
much.
For your time.
Fantastic.
Lovely
thank
chat
you.
To you. Thanks so much. Yeah. Thank you.
Another wonderful piece of score from Furiosa, a Mad Max saga, which rounds off this latest episode of Soundtrackin' with director George Miller and composer Tom Holkenberg, and our special BMW Cannes episode. My huge thanks to George and Tom for taking the time to talk to us, especially Tom for the morning after the premiere, to their teams for helping facilitate those opportunities, the family at Warners for their support, and also the brilliant BMW team for giving us the opportunity to be part of this year's Cannes Film Festival, whilst also celebrating their partnership and commitment to the creative industries. If you'd like to hear my previous conversation with Tom, then just head to edithbowman.com and use the search function. It's where you can find all of our previous episodes of Soundtrackin' or on your usual podcast provider. Please do check out our YouTube channel where we'll be posting both those interviews for you to watch, and why not subscribe whilst you're there? You can also follow us on socials. We are at Soundtrackin' UK. Next up then, I'm thrilled to be joined by composer Amelia Warner to talk about her beautiful score for the new Daisy Ridley film, Young Woman and the Sea, which, if you'd like to see the film, why not come along to our next Soundtrackin' Everyman Film Club on the 28th of May at Everyman Broadgate for a preview screening followed by an in-conversation with director Joachim Ronen and legendary producer Jerry Bruckheimer. All details can be found on our Instagram. Either way, join us next week as we welcome back Amelia. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.